From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, as more people begin to return to work, can employers require workers to get the COVID-19 vaccine? And should they?
But as long as an employer, a public employer, has a rational reason for that kind of a requirement, I don't see that challenge being successful.
Then, the institution that banded Michigan farmers together at a time when social glue was hard to come by.
First and foremost, it was a place to socialize. You were there to meet people, to make friends, to make connections. Today, we call this networking.
Also, one doctor in training writes about her time at a Detroit hospital during the early months of the pandemic.
You question so many aspects of it. Are you actually really even helping people? Like, what are you actually doing? And it's hard to see it when you're so in it.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a young neurologist writes about her time at Henry Ford during COVID.
When you only see a lot of these patients while they're acutely ill in the hospital, and you don't get to see them leaving, and that makes you question the futility of what you're doing.
Selena Mahmoud joins us to share from her new essay collection later in the show. But first, we want to talk about where work is headed with so many people headed back to work. 55% of Michiganders have received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. That is the first threshold in Governor Gretchen Whitmer's plan, tying the loosening of pandemic restrictions to vaccination rates. And it lifts the ban on non-essential employees heading back to work. But after more than a year in work-from-home mode, what will this actually mean to workplaces, employers, and staff? Can your boss require you to get a vaccine? Can you keep working from home if you're not comfortable going back to the office? And what does the law say about public institutions and public-facing businesses? With us today is Stacey Hickox, an employment law expert and associate professor at Michigan State University's School for Human Resources and Labor Relations. Stacey, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So the state says that employers may return their workers to the job site 2 weeks after the governor's announcement. Can employers require their workers to do so?
Well, you know, like most legal questions, it's a depends kind of question. And so if the employer has a business justification for having the employee in the office, then they can require that, even if the person has a specific reason for not returning. So for example, if somebody has a disability and doesn't want to expose themselves to the virus in the workplace, that could be a reasonable accommodation. But if their work requires them to actually be in the office, then the employer could even require them to come in.
I suppose that for many Michiganders, this question is a little bit late. Are there workers who might already have lost their jobs if they decline to return to the workplace?
I think that's very possible, right? Because I know even if someone doesn't have a disability, I know of people that are concerned about going back to work. They might have a family member that has a health issue that they're worried about transmitting the virus back to their family member. And so I do think some people are dropping out and people are dropping out for other reasons as well, like supervising children that are at home from school and that kind of thing.
Sure. Let's talk about the safety of those who might be returning to work within the coming weeks. We're finally at a point where demand for vaccines is leveling out. Do you see employers requiring workers to get vaccinated?
I think some will. I've seen one survey of employers that says about 20% of them will require it. And many of them are in the professions you would expect, like in the healthcare industry and that kind of thing. But I think most employers are instead just trying to encourage their employees to get a vaccine. And some are even providing incentives, like giving them the time off to go get the vaccine, maybe even some other, you know, little perks if they do agree to get the vaccine.
I wonder if sometimes in discussing the safety of the workplace in terms of vaccination, we miss out on the bigger picture of what safety in the workplace means. What kind of protections might workers who are public facing, say waiters and servers in restaurants and gym staff, what kind of protections might they have if they think their employer is not taking appropriate safety precautions?
Well, there's a couple of different things they can go to. Number one are the Occupational Safety and Health Administration standards, right, which they are directly looking to the CDC the Center for Disease Control as far as what is safe and what isn't. And so there are federal OSHA guidelines, and then there are state MyOSHA guidelines that are very similar. And so an employee can look to those guidelines and really expect their employer to follow those guidelines, as that employer's duty is to protect the health and safety of their workers. And then if an employee is actually becomes ill because of COVID, then they may have a workers' compensation claim against their employer.
There was a story on MLive 2 days ago that noted to date, as of that reporting, 280 workplaces had been hit with a citation or fine. Is there anything you can tell us about the state's infrastructure for investigating OSHA complaints?
Well, I'm sure they're overwhelmed right now with that many complaints. You know, they have a limited number of investigators. And so that's one issue. It's just a lack of resources. And the other thing I would say is that, you know, these OSHA violations carry fines, but oftentimes the fine is not very significant. So it might be a few hundred dollars or $1,000. And so for an employer that's, you know, choosing between staying open for business and being closed down, they may say, well, we'll risk getting the fine because it's worth it for us to stay open and to, you know, conduct our business the way we want to.
Stacey, at this stage of the game, COVID vaccinations have been authorized for use by the FDA on an emergency basis, but they haven't received full approval. And that may be on people's minds as they're thinking about a vaccination decision. Does it make any difference in terms of leverage for legal cases in which workers might try to challenge a vaccine mandate?
You know, I don't think so. I think because you have the suggestion from the Center for Disease Control and from OSHA that employees should get vaccinated, and you have, you know, legitimate concerns on the employer's part with respect to having their employees vaccinated because they don't want to have that workers' compensation liability. They don't want to be liable to customers or clients that become infected because of their employees. And so I think that will balance out any hesitation on the part of their employees. But that being said, you know, there have been claims already made that by people with disabilities who aren't able to get the vaccine safely. And there have been a few rumblings about religious reasons for not getting the vaccine, because, of course, someone has a right to be accommodated for religious reasons as well.
Yeah. Do you see any difference between the case to vaccinate public sector workers versus vaccinating private sector workers? Does the law hold any differences in those two spaces?
Not really. I mean, you have the same OSHA guidelines and the same requirements to accommodate workers, whether you're in the public sector or the private sector. The only thing I could think of is, you know, the public sector, of course, has an obligation to follow the Constitution. So I suppose someone could bring some sort of equal protection claim if they claimed that the requirement to get vaccinated was somehow unreasonable or, you know, unrelated to any valid employer interest. But I really think that would be a stretch.
Yeah. A couple of weeks ago, the University of Michigan announced that it will be requiring students who live on campus to be vaccinated. Now, obviously, they're not employees of the university. But as we think about, as we start to think about higher education and requirements for vaccination, first of all, do you think that there might be legal challenges to that, and any predictions on how this might work out?
Well, so it seems like the rule of the day is that people are bringing legal challenges about everything related to COVID. So I wouldn't be surprised if someone were to challenge that. I know there have been some challenges in Texas about vaccinations. So I wouldn't be surprised if they challenged it. But like I said, as long as an employer, a public employer, has a rational reason for that kind of a requirement, I don't see that challenge being successful.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that what we're starting to see with universities talk about students, do you think that might lay groundwork for requiring people who enter university buildings, by which I mean staff, instructors, faculty, requiring them to be vaccinated as well?
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, it's whoever you come into contact with that poses a risk. And, you know, I think universities, just like any other employer, are worried about their liability with respect to keeping other employees safe.
The state legislature's Republican majority has been doing some work on bills that would try to preemptively outlaw local governments to issue or incentivize vaccine passports that might let vaccinated people do things that those who have not been vaccinated cannot do, such as attending a large concert. Governor Whitmer has said that the state has no plans to do something like this. If we could just enter the speculative world for a minute, do you see that those kinds of passports having firm legal ground to stand on?
I think there's certainly, you know, just like we were talking about the vaccinations, I think having the passport makes, some rational sense when you're looking at government action. And that's really the standard for any kind of governmental restriction, you know, unless there was some group arguing that this restricted their religious freedom, for example. I mean, I could see maybe not requiring those kinds of passports for churches and those kinds of organizations, because we've already seen those challenges with respect to gathering in large groups. But if you're talking about a concert or any other just kind of public activity, I don't see why a public local government wouldn't be able to control people's behavior in those settings, just like they can control, you know, issuing licenses for parades and use of parks and, you know, all the other restrictions that local governments have.
I know that there is an aspirational world of positive changes that could come out of the pandemic, and then the reality world that many people are finding themselves going back to right now. But what are the accommodations that you think might become more accepted or possibly more protected coming out of this pandemic that might change the game for workers and working families for good?
Well, certainly remote work, right? So a lot of surveys have been done of employers of whether they will allow more remote work, and all of them are saying yes. You know, maybe not full-time remote work, but certainly on a part-time basis. And a lot of employers have already adopted new policies about working remotely. And some employers are going completely remote, right? They're just giving up their office space, saving that money, and allowing their employees to work remotely. And so I think we're going to see a real shift. You know, not everyone, right? Some people are going to want to come back to work, and some employers are going to want their employees back in the office at least part of the time. But I think that what this pandemic has proven is that a lot of people can be effective and productive working from home.
Michigan State Associate Professor Stacy Hickox. She's in the School of Human Resources and Labor Relations. Stacy, thank you very much for talking with us.
No problem.
After the break, we head back to the farm, looking into the history and surprisingly progressive legacy of the Grange in Michigan. That's next. Stay with us. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. Traveling around Michigan, you might have noticed small, century-old buildings with the word Grange at the top. In rural areas, these buildings sometimes seem like they're in the middle of nowhere. And in urban places, like, for example, Ann Arbor, a Grange building can be surrounded by a sea of strip malls and subdivisions, but it's still there, an aging relic from a bygone era. Now, if you do live in Michigan's farm country, you probably know what I'm talking about. And if not, the question that pops up might be, what's a Grange? With us today to talk more about the Grange in agriculture, equality, and other sectors of Michigan life is Jillian Reese of the Michigan History Center. Jillian, welcome back to Stateside.
Glad to be back.
So for the agriculturally challenged among us, what is a Grange?
The Grange is a fraternal organization for both men and women, and it's very similar to groups like the Freemasons, the Odd Fellows, even Rotary International. But the Grange focused specifically on farming and rural life in the United States. Its big sort of focus and mission was on community building in rural areas, and then turned into more of an advocacy group for farmers. They would advocate for specific public policy, and also as a way to educate farmers on new and best practices in agriculture. The Grange has a very specific structure. There is the National Grange, which is, you know, the organization that lobbies Congress and interacts with the Department of Agriculture on a federal level. There are state granges. Ours is called the Michigan State Grange, which interacts with the government on a statewide level, but also runs statewide education programs and outreach programs. There's the Panoma Granges, which are at the county level. And then there are subordinate granges, which are the local granges. And these are really the center of the rural life communities. You know, those buildings that you were talking about would have been the meeting houses for these local granges.
When did the Grange get going, both nationally and here in Michigan?
The National Grange was organized in 1867 in Washington, D.C., in the years after the American Civil War. And there had been a movement in the Northeast to sort of have clubs that would focus on rural needs, and these were called granges. And then also a push from the federal government to sort of research agriculture in the South in a post-slavery world. And the movement really caught on quite quickly from there. The first grange in Michigan was Burnside Grange Number 1. That was actually in Lapeer County, and they were formed in 1872. And then the Michigan State Grange as a statewide organization of about a member, about 20 different granges across the state, was founded in Kalamazoo in 1873. And by 1876, there were hundreds of granges throughout Michigan and tens of thousands of members. So it was very popular and grew very, very quickly in the 1870s.
Jillian, what do we know about rural farm life at that time in Michigan? What would some of the challenges have been that farming families would have been up against and the issues that would have been really pressing for them?
Yeah, I mean, when we think about rural farm life during this time, you know, it was a much larger part of Michigan's population and economy. You know, majority of people in Michigan would have been working in the agricultural market. And there were other industries that would impact rural life. Mining and lumbering were one of them. But even then, there was usually in mining towns and lumber camps, there was a little bit more densely populated area to support the camp's needs. Whereas, you know, farming life, you need large stretches of land of people who were connected on a market level, but maybe had a little bit less populated on the community level in terms of density. It was a time period after the American Civil War where agriculture was seeing this push to be more focused on scientific agriculture. And developing scientific agriculture was a huge driver in the displacement of Native communities in Michigan after the American Civil War and sort of involvement in the scientific or professional agriculture system would become a signifier to whether or not Native Americans living in Michigan were considered to be quote unquote civilized, which had impacts on their citizenship and their voting rights. If they were involved in agriculture, that was an easy way to prove that they had become part of Michigan's community in the eyes of the law. And when we sometimes think about farming, we don't tend to think about that sort of scientific side of it. There was an industrial revolution happening in manufacturing, but that was happening on the farm too. You're seeing a huge influx of mechanization on farms. The ag school here in East Lansing was started in 1855 as a way to sort of professionalize the field and to elevate farming and to say to people that farming was an as important field of study as philosophy or medicine, something that you should go to a four-year college to learn about. And the Agricultural College of the State of Michigan was the first of its kind in the country. So Michigan was on the forefront of this sort of industrial revolution within farming.
So with that in mind, that there was this concept of modernization and science that was driving a lot of what was happening. What was the Grange doing for Michigan settler farming families? I mean, was the idea to try to get people who were farming in this new way to sort of think about and learn about some of the new practices? Or what exactly happened at Grange meetings?
So first and foremost, it was a place to socialize and to build community. A majority of the things that people did at Grange meetings was very similar to any fraternal organization. You know, you were there to meet people, to make friends, to make connections. Today we call this networking, but they would have done social leisure activities, putting on plays, pageants that were focused on farming, but they would also, you know, be interested in other issues and topics for sure. But I think the long-lasting sort of national and statewide legacy of the Grange was this increase in political power of rural farming communities at a time where they're starting to see a depopulation from rural areas of the state into more urban areas. And in the 1870s and the 1880s, when the Grange was being established in Michigan, that depopulation had already started. But especially after the kickoff of the automotive industry and the mass industrialization around that in urban areas, there was even more of a movement of people from rural to urban places. So it honestly offered rural communities that visibility on a statewide level and to lobby collectively for policies that were seen by the Grange as quote unquote sort of rural America policies, things that would improve the lives of rural Americans. So it was the education, it was networking, but then it was also sort of this public policy think tank from the community level up.
If you're just tuning in, I'm talking with the Michigan History Center's Jillian Reese about the history and legacy of the Grange. This agriculture advocacy group is in part responsible for a lot of things we take for granted today, like flat rate shipping at the post office and securing women the right to vote. Jillian, 21st century Michigan tends to think of rural areas as being quite conservative. But from what you're saying, it kind of sounds like the Grange in its early days at least saw itself as fairly progressive, notwithstanding who it was advocating for and some of the folks who were getting displaced by farming at that point.
Yeah, you know, we always need to remember that these terms, conservative, liberal, progressive, they're changing depending on the context and the time period that we're in. In terms of the late 1800s and sort of what the Grange was advocating for, in some ways, we would certainly see these as progressive, but there were other things that they believed in and they were pushing for that would be considered to be conservative today. So one of the things that the Grange was really known for was checking the power of big railroad monopolies. They argued successfully that interstate commerce, specifically with railroads at the time, should be seen as a public utility in which the federal government and the state government needed to intercede to make sure that the owners of these railroads weren't exploiting, particularly farmers, with their price for transportation. But that groundwork of understanding interstate commerce as a public utility would later be used as a way to fight discrimination on the basis of public accommodation. So the most, I think, famous of this is based on racial discrimination. And so there are similar sorts of arguments around what the Grange was trying to do with railroad monopolies, as you would see with people trying to fight Jim Crow laws in the South. They were also an organization that lobbied for free delivery for post in rural communities and the expansion of the U.S. Postal Service to rural communities so that farmers didn't have to travel so far to get their mail. This led to improvements on rural roads because if a postal worker is traveling on these roads, they need to be at least passable. And then also a federal involvement in the parcel post system. So those flat rate boxes that you use at USPS is a direct result of the lobbying of the Grange. They supported a progressive federal income tax that they thought would encourage family-sized farms as opposed to a more corporate farming model. They were interested in farming cooperatives. So, you know, the idea of a member-owned commerce. But then, you know, they were also very involved in the temperance movement and thought that the sale of alcohol and to some extent tobacco should be regulated by the state and federal government.
You sent over some interesting information about how the Grange got involved in the suffrage movement.
Yes.
Was temperance the doorway that got the Grange involved in women getting the right to vote?
I think it was a couple different things. From the start, the Grange was an organization that supported membership for men and women on an equal basis, which even today, there are many fraternal organizations that are gender specific. So they, by making men and women have equal membership and allowing women to have leadership positions from the start, they equated women's issues with farming issues. So when women had a lack of political power, when women couldn't vote, that would end up hurting some of the public policy initiatives that the Grange was pushing forward. So on the one hand, there was sort of a altruistic background to this where, you know, the farm and men and women on the farm were seen as sort of in partnership with one another, that both of their work was necessary for the farm to be successful. But at the same time, they understood that they had a large number of folks that couldn't vote, that if they got the right to vote, would vote for things like temperance, things like progressive income tax. So, you know, there was a practical reason why they wanted to support women's suffrage. And it went beyond just individual policy issues.
Right. Jillian, I wonder, do you know much about what was behind the initial decision to allow women to have leadership positions in the Grange?
It was really, you know, I think it was sort of the basis of these values in sort of what they saw as the most efficient way to run a farm. That the farm was based on the family, that a family needed, you know, at the time, a family needed husband and a wife. And we have a broadside in our collection that I think really kind of gets this message across. It's a women's suffrage broadside in support of a suffrage amendment in 1912. And it says, the farmer knows the farm that is run without a woman's help isn't much of a farm. A government that is run without a woman's help is a one-sided government. So I think if you see women's roles on the farm as important as a man's roles on the farm, it's only natural to the Grange then to allow women to have leadership positions and to run Granges. And then all of a sudden, if you have women in these leadership positions, their issues become synonymous with the organization issues, which is why the Michigan State Grange is the first statewide organization in the state to support women's suffrage. And that's even before the Michigan State Federation of Women's Clubs, which is a group that only allows women as members. So, you know, by having this sort of mixing of the genders, there is more of an appreciation for some of the ways that women are discriminated against in the United States.
Are there ways the Grange is still active today?
Yeah, so the Grange is still a national organization that advocates for the needs of farms and rural Americans. Things like the 4-H Club, which I think is an organization that's in a lot of rural high schools, is a arm of the Grange. Today, the Grange has about 150,000 members. So there's still a large community of Grangers. There's about 1,700 local Granges across the United States. They do exactly the thing that they were doing in the late 19th century, which is offering rural Americans a space to not only gather and to build their own communities, but then also to advocate for their needs on a state and national level.
Jillian Reese of the Michigan History Center. Jillian, thank you so much for getting us up to speed on what the Grange did and what it's still doing today.
Thanks.
We so appreciate having you tune in for Stateside every day. But we'd love to actually hear from you, too. Let us know what's going on in your corner of the state and maybe some stories that we might be missing. You can also connect with other listeners and Stateside staff about the show. There are a couple of places to find us. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Also, you can find us on Facebook on the Michigan Radio page or send us an email. Our address is stateside@michiganradio.org. Coming up, Selena Mahmood talks about getting her sea legs as a doctor during the pandemic and, at the same time, finding her voice as a writer.
It didn't feel real to me, so I wanted to somehow make it real, and that's why I mostly started writing, because it was important and it meant a lot, and I just didn't know how to process it.
She'll read from her new book of essays after the break. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Our hospitals have been likened to war zones during the COVID pandemic. For those of us who aren't on the front lines, it might be a little hard to imagine the scope of what it's been like this past year. One Michigan doctor is, in the form of a new book, offering readers a glimpse of her experiences working as a first-year neurology resident at a Detroit hospital during the pandemic. Dr. Selena Mahmood is a second-year neurology resident at Henry Ford Health System. Her book, A Pandemic in Residence, Essays from a Detroit Hospital, publishes May 18th. It reads like a combination of essay collection, diary, scientific article, cultural commentary, and poetry. And it illuminates with sharp, elegant prose that artfully blends fact with feeling, a year like no other. Dr. Mahmood, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thank you.
Hey, could we start out with you telling us just a little bit about your path into medicine?
Sure. So I was born into a family of physicians. My grandparents are doctors. My parents are doctors. So I think it was kind of always expected of me, and I kind of fell into it. But I think even things you fall into, you have a moment where you kind of realize, okay, this is what I want to do. I think for me, that moment of realization was possibly in the middle of undergrad, where I realized, okay, I want to be a physician. And at that point, I wasn't sure exactly what I wanted to specialize in. That I realized only later in med school, where I realized I wanted to do something with the brain and I ended up doing neurology.
Yeah. Likewise, how did you become a writer?
I didn't start really writing until undergrad. I know people start off saying they like always wrote as like kids in diaries and stuff. I tried getting into diaries when I was in high school, but I could never really get into it because it also always felt like I was writing for somebody, but it was just a very strange experience for me and I couldn't get into it. Undergrad, I started off in NYU and one of the required courses is writing the essay. And it's one of their actually pretty popular classes. And that's when I fell in love with the essay form and with writing more specifically, just because I had never looked at writing as such an active process. Like they would send us out to the city, like to the Met, to find things that sort of grabbed our attention and to incorporate that. And then she would use our instructor, she would use like letter writing and reformat that into essays. Like I basically fell in love with the essay. I think that's what happened. Yeah. And I sort of continued writing after that.
Yeah. So I remember in the winter of 2019-2020, when we were first hearing about this illness, a lot of us weren't sure how big a deal it was going to be. And so there you were in your first year of residency. At what point did you see COVID as the truck in the oncoming lane?
So I think the moment I realized it was when they shut down all elective surgeries. Like, there was definitely a buildup up to everything. And it's like, there was so much uncertainty even in our hospitals. Like, I remember some people were telling us not to wear masks and others were wearing it despite, like, ID people telling us we didn't need to wear it. And that was all the way up until even a week when they said it was a pandemic. So there was just so much uncertainty. And it's like, is this going to become pertinent to Detroit? What's going on? And then it's when they stopped all the elective surgeries that we were like, oh my God, okay, it's hitting us.
Yeah. Do you mind reading from the book for us?
So from the beginning?
Yeah, just maybe as much of the first pages makes sense to you.
Okay, so this is from the first essay. It's titled Testing. It has subtitles for the days, so it starts off with Sunday. Sometimes it takes the collapse of a system to see things clearly. I'm 3/4 into my first year as a neurology resident. The World Health Organization declared a coronavirus pandemic on March 11, 2020, and Donald Trump announced a national emergency in the White House Rose Garden on the 13th. Just for cultural pin dropping, the top 3 songs on this week's Billboard Hot 100, The Box by Roddy Ricch, Life is Good with Future and Drake, and Circles by Post Malone. The Weeknd's new album, After Hours, is dropping in a week. The bars are emptying as we try to make sense of it all. A neurology department-wide Skype meeting is held on Sunday, March 15. Dua Lipa's Don't Start Now has replaced Post Malone's song. Medical students will no longer be rotating in the hospital. Everything that can be done remotely will be off-site. I pace the ground floor at home, microphone muted, listening to the neurology chair's reassuring voice punctuated by 60 chaotic others. In med school, we'd studied the last influenza pandemic, known as the Spanish flu, which at the end of World War I killed more people than the war itself. We learned the properties of orthomyxovirus that allow it to quickly mutate, and that it was only a matter of time before another flu pandemic came around. COVID-19, a shorthand for coronavirus disease 2019, is from a different family, Coronaviridae, of which SARS and MERS are also a part. The argument in the news media about this not being just the flu has been baffling. Just the flu has its own weighty mortality in elderly and immunocompromised populations. There are 2 modalities to medicine, immortal and mortal. The immortal part is the education and research that goes into it and naturally draws the human ego and senses. Positive ssRNA, RNA-dependent RNA polymerase, genetic recombination. The mortal part is the craft, which involves patient care and requires the creation of purpose out of purposelessness. How not to have a God complex and still serve. What's the uncliched verb for what we're supposed to be doing?
Selena Mahmood, when I saw the title of your book, a part of me just sort of went, uh-oh, in terms of what I was expecting in terms of the pandemic narrative and just what would be going on with you in this book and the challenges that you'd be going through. I mean, medical residency can be a really rough ride under any circumstances. This is a time when people are being pushed to their limits. The hours are legendarily long, although some of that's changing. And it's a time when people are finding out if they're really cut out for what they've chosen to do. And then doing all this during the pandemic, when many of our hospitals, especially in Detroit, were just literally under siege. What did it mean to you to be writing about this experience?
So I started off writing about it mostly as just notes on a daily basis, because while it was going on, I was like, I want to remember this. So it just started off as that initially. While it was going on, though, I also, like, there was so much sensationalism around it as well, very quickly on the media, and it didn't feel real to me. So I wanted to somehow make it real. And that's why I mostly started writing, because it was important and it meant a lot. And I just didn't know how to process it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like we said, you're a neurology resident, but as the pandemic started to hit, you and your fellow interns were redeployed, was the term of art, to a new COVID floor?
Yeah.
What did that mean in terms of the type of work that you were doing every day?
Oh, drastically different. It was different from anything we'd done before, either on internal medicine or neurology or anywhere else. It required isolation in every single room. Two, they had to pull in staff to cover the floors. Three, we didn't even really know what we were doing. They had like basic algorithms, but even then it was just there. It's not like they had run a kind of demo before figuring out what to do. So I remember literally the first day we walked in, the attending probably knew as much as we did. We just had like a quick lecture on just like what we knew about the virus itself and what worked so far at that point. And at that point, we were still using, we weren't doing steroids. We were doing azithromycin and hydroxychloroquine. And yeah, we walked in the morning at 6 a.m. and we didn't have any protective gear either. So the nurses were literally scrambling to figure out where to get that from as well. And that took a few hours for them to figure out where to get it from. And even then, it was like very basic supplies. And then once that floor opened up, we literally got so many admissions. Like we were slammed within the first hour. And I don't think we were really expecting it. Like we knew the cases were rising. We just weren't expecting the floor to literally fill up within the first couple of hours.
Yeah. There's a passage on page 35 that sort of speaks to what was going through your mind as you had to adapt. Do you mind reading a little bit for us?
Yeah. So this is from Orona. Scratch that all on the floor. It's the evening of March 24, and my neurology co-interns and I got notified that we're being redeployed, that is, pulled from our current rotations to make a new COVID floor. Not gonna lie, I was scared. Not gonna lie, I wavered. I'm going and I can't believe the sentimentality is spewing from my mouth, but damn, it really feels like we're going to war. I moved out the day following my draft, in keeping with that ongoing metaphor. My parents are in a concerning age bracket with associated comorbidities. I emailed the program coordinator for some sort of temporary lodging. Until then, I'm living with one of the other interns. I packed some of my belongings and random house supplies in case I end up needing to rent a place. My mother filled a laundry basket with fruit and entirely too much food. I carried it out of the garage into the dark, airless night and put it in the back seat of my silver baby SUV. No one knows how long this is going to last. While we're constantly being told by sources on social media, by self-help gurus, to focus on the present, I appreciate Frankl's emphasis on what is an imagination of time, a circular creation of looking into the past from a future moment to create the present. He writes about how meaning-making is intertwined with the future. If we are able to envision a future from which we can retrospectively make sense of the past, a meaningful present is created. Moreover, make your life about meaning and side wishes might ensue.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Selina Mahmoud. She is a second-year neurology resident with Henry Ford Health System. Her new book is called A Pandemic in Residence, Essays from a Detroit Hospital. One of the things I love about your essays is that you definitely give us that piece of the crisis and your experience of it. But there's just so much other stuff in here from, like, you know, again, the songs that were you know, people were listening to at the time, little bits of Pakistani American history, little medical topics that just I didn't know about. Were these elements you needed just because it was part of the flow of what was going through your head?
Yeah, and it's interesting because it started off more about those things, and I found myself thinking about those things a lot, and they were grounded in the pandemic rather than it being the other way around, if that makes sense. It started off very like free-flowing, automatic thought writing, and then I realized it was just hovering over ground and I needed to ground it. And I realized a lot of these thoughts were being manifest from what was going on around me. And it was almost like a reverse process of that manifestation and grounding it in the pandemic.
You know, we don't do a terribly good job of treating doctors like human beings. I think that's true from the administrative end as well as the patient end in different ways. And I think that was one of the things that that level of detail kind of helped me with as I was thinking about people, you know, across the medical profession and sort of how they were experiencing this. Can you talk at all about being in these spaces and seeing what you saw and helping the people you were able to help and, you know, watching people who you weren't able to help? Were there moments at which you started to question whether this was really what you're meant to do for your career?
Yeah, I think I wouldn't be a resident if I didn't do that multiple times during my intern year. I'm sure it may have been expounded by the pandemic. But yeah, I thought about it multiple times, especially because you question so many aspects of it. Are you actually really even helping people? Like, what are you actually doing? And it's hard to see it when you're so in it, if you're actually doing anything to help others. I know it's like strange to think about because then you watch shows and you're like, oh no, I actually like am doing things and doctors do things. But when you're living through it on a minute by minute, day to day basis, one, you only see a lot of these patients while they're acutely ill in the hospital and you don't get to see them leaving and integrating into their family and society again. So missing out on that facet of things, I think, gives you a one view things of what's happening inside the hospital. And that makes you question the futility of what you're doing. I was actually meant to be on my first outpatient month when I was redeployed. So I never got to see patients leave the hospital and come in and see what they were like back in their normal lives.
Right. At the same time, There is one essay that you close with the sentence, "That was the first time I started looking at medicine, not as a walkway between life and death, but rather as a creative process of healing and innovation." That is such a striking framing of medicine as a creative process and something that we really don't hear very often. Can you say more about how you came to view medicine in this way?
Yeah, so I think I initially started off trying to make meaning out of it being like, okay, we're saving lives. And that one, puts a lot of pressure on everything. And two, when patients do end up dying after a prolonged course and you've put in hours and hours and months into caring for a patient and then to suddenly have them pass away, it's kind of devastating for you and then you don't know how to make sense of it either. And it's like, okay, how do I make sense of all this energy and emotional and physical energy I put into caring for this for this human? And in the end, they ended up passing away. So that's when I'm like, okay, I have to find another way to make meaning of this because this is going to lead to me burning out. So then I was like, okay, this is more of... it makes more sense for this to be a process of discovering life and discovering more about diseases and what I can. And if I focus on that rather than this being solely a life and death purpose, that makes more sense to me.
I mean, the fact that you're a second year neurology resident tells me maybe the answer to this question, but are you going to stick with neurology?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think you'll keep writing?
I hope so. But I mean, I'm going to write either way. Whether I publish something else is, I guess, another question.
Well, Selena Mahmood, thank you so much for this collection. It's it feels like an important artifact of what everybody's been through, but also just a really good collection of essays.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Selena Mahmood's new book is A Pandemic in Residence: Essays from a Detroit Hospital. It publishes on May 18th. Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Newhan, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time.